I submitted a written report. The big news is library hours. Yay! We added 66 public hours a week across the 10 branches on January 1st. And we celebrated around the system. For example, at this library, we now open at 10 o'clock in the morning.
It was June.
What did I say, John?
January.
June 1st. You're absolutely right. Thank you. The new hours are included in the packet, but I think we're all very excited about it. We're going to be able to do things like offer Sunday hours in the valleys. Garfield Park is going to be open on Saturdays for the first time in years. We're hoping it makes a real difference in the lives of our patrons. We started the Downtown Library Advisory Committee, not to be confused with this group, which is the Library Advisory Committee or the Capitola Library Advisory Committee. The Downtown Library Advisory Committee has been put together by the City of Santa Cruz to really look at the building of the Downtown Library. They've selected 10 members of the community to lead that. We've just begun discussions, had our very first meeting. They've hired Noel and Tam to lead the process, which is kind of interesting because Noel and Tam is doing the Capitola Library and now doing the Felton Interiors. And I would just say it's not, I think, a pre-bias towards Noel and Tam. I think they do a very good job in the interview process and are building some really innovative libraries across Northern and Central California. So we're excited to get them on board to help us figure out what we're going to do downtown.
They're not the architect.
Oh, yeah, I should clarify. Janice is correct. They're going to help us write the program, the sort of the pre-concept, and there will be a process to hire the actual architect. This is really going into where should the library be and what programs and services should it offer. It's sort of what, like, Capitola and Felton had done prior to Measure S, that level of work. Does that make sense? And I think that's all I have. And so I just want to set it even higher. The Library Advisory Committee is really looking at the library strategic plan and what do we do operationally. And so they're taking a topic every month to really analyze sort of where the library is going. And so this month we decided to talk about history and history programming and services.
I'm very excited that Deborah and Anne are here to talk about local history resources, because the one thing about public libraries, we have a lot in common with our colleagues all over the country, but for each public library, the one thing that each public library can do is provide the local resources for the community, and nobody else can do that but each library in each jurisdiction. And Deborah and Anne are working on not just gathering the local resources, but finding out the best ways of presenting what we have so it's usable to people of all ages, because we do have people of all ages using these resources. It's not just someone doing local history or doing family history. It could be children, it could be usually fourth graders. And sometimes more, lots of people are interested. So I'm very pleased. Deborah is a reference librarian who specializes in local history. And Anne is our genius webmaster who works on the website and does all kinds of things. So I'm going to hand it over to Deborah and Anne. I'm not sure who's talking first, but there we go.
I think I can go first.
please join us. That would be great.
Hello. Thank you. And Anne and I are both really happy to be able to talk to you about Welcome to Street Resources, especially now as the library has new building plans. And it's important to think about where the resources will be kept, how to preserve them, how to make them accessible to people. And besides being a county resource of things that, you know, patrons here use, the collections that we have are a really regional resource, and they stretch across the country and around the world now through the internet. So it's important to look like locally, but also like regionally for the kinds of things that the library has, and then internationally, and how it's important. As Jen said, that the Santa Cruz Library is really, we're the only ones collecting this material. And if it shows up on the internet, it's because we put it there. So I was glad to that in the board, in your packet, that there's a couple of handouts, which is background information. About 5 years ago, a California preservation expert from the state, we got a grant from the state library. So a preservation expert from UC Berkeley came and spent a couple of days analyzing the library's local district collections, with made recommendations about how to preserve this. And so in the handout is his recommendation, or at least a part of it, of what. And it's important to recognize that they said this, that these are seen as important resources, and that we need to, it's our responsibility to keep them. And then the other handout with that was something that I wrote to show how local history fits in with the library's strategic plan and its overall how it works. So if you have those, if you would like, I could use some of those handouts too. Just hand out. If you want to just keep them, if anybody needs one, just take it. If not, it's just background information, and I'm glad that that can get into your packet, so I don't have to spend a lot of time just giving you some background about what that is. And I do want to stress the point that Janice made, that even though the local history resources, the print material is really only about 2 or 3% of the collection, it does have a huge impact. And Santa Cruz, the library is doing really what no other institution in the county is doing, that the Museum of Art and History has some good resources, but they're more involved in collecting archives and in physical materials. And they also have a group of researchers called Researchers Anonymous. And they've asked the library to work with them to have a history form on the library's website. So I think I see the role of the library enlarging and doing some of the things that the museum can't do. Plus, UCSC is another really valuable resource, and they have great special collections. And when they started, about 50 years ago, 1965, there were librarians there who were really conscious about collecting local history, and they have a great resource. But as time has gone on, their resources have become limited and are not collecting as much. And an example of that is they have a map library that we refer to people a lot to go up there and see the maps, and they have a great collection. But in the last few years, they've closed that. They digitized some of their maps, and then people have to make appointments to go to special collections. So, again, the public library has a central role in making sure that these resources are available to everyone. Okay. And I did also, there is a McCaskill Trust for Local History, which is a smallish endowment, I think, that provides some money each year, mostly to buy books on Santa Cruz County. But I see this as another opportunity, especially as the building, new buildings, is to find some great donors maybe who are interested in supporting California and the local history room. So there's opportunities there for a lot of donations and support. When I talk about local history, I have what I mean by that, and I have a handout here that kind of briefly describes. One, two, three, four. the different actual resources in the library. And we'll talk about the web portion of this. So I want to talk about the other part, the actual physical materials that we have. In the downtown branch, there's a local history room. And this started about 5 years ago when the library was going through a lot of changes. And I realized that a lot of the local reference material was not in a central location, and it was not necessarily secure. So there was a small room in the downtown branch. It's pretty anonymous. It has a little slide on it saying staff only. But if you want to look in sometimes, I'm sure someone, open it for you. But it started out, it had a long history. But it was a place where the library's clipping files were. And this is one of the things that the library's been doing for many, many years now, is indexing the Sentinel and clipping out articles for local history. So those are not local history, but just topics of interest locally. And so there's file cabinets of that material, and we made room in there then to add some of the books that we collected throughout the system, say the last copy of important material that we needed to make sure it kept safe. So that's the material that's in there now. There's about 1,000 books. And along with that, there's a map collection and a vertical file of other kinds of historical material. And how this whole local history room started was with a collection of Faye Ellis, who was a researcher from the San Lorenzo Valley. And she donated her research to the library, and it's about a 4-drawer file cabinet, mostly genealogy and history, everything about San Lorenzo Valley. So I got a grant from the state library to start digitizing some of this material, making it available to everyone. So that's sort of an ongoing project. And when we realized how that was moving and how important it was to do this, then it was easier to put everything in this room, all the local history, to keep everything there. So that's the core collection. It's all just like last copies of important material on the county that needs to be preserved. A larger collection on the back is in the Californiana room, and this is all a circulating collection, which has not only material in Santa Cruz County, but it is an in-depth collection on California history, which I want to emphasize is a really unique resource. In 1965, there was a man who worked with the Sentinel called Preston Sawyer, who I call him like a Forrest Gump character in a way. He knew everybody, basically pretty much over the first 50 years of the century. In Santa Cruz, and not only did he know everybody, and he wrote columns for the Sentinel, but he also was a real collector of books on California history. And at some point, in 1965, he donated his collections to both the library and to UCSC. And UCSC has all his photographs in the library, I think, got most of his books. So it's a core collection. And at some point, a couple years ago, I was weeding it, finding homes for duplicates and finding things that we didn't need, and did lots of looking online at other libraries in the state, and found that a lot of the resources that are in that room are available maybe only at Stanford or only at Berkeley. So again, I want to stress it's not just Santa Cruz that can benefit from this, but it's a real Central Coast regional resource. And along those lines, there is a section of small books, maybe about 500 in a locked case. And these are unique items in California history that are considered pretty rare. And one of those things, again, is a special collection that's really not available anywhere else. It's a collection called the Panama Pacific Exhibition in San Francisco in 1915. And I think the reason the library has this is Robert Sessman, you know, of the Sessman House, Cabrillo, I believe from what I gathered that he was on the executive board of that commission, of that exposition. And either he or someone else donated it. It's a complete, it's if you're interested, it's really charming to see a wide range of things on the exposition. And not only that one, but other expositions, because that was a big deal at that time to have these World's Fairs. So that's one of the things that's in there. Besides California, there's a microfilm, and then the genealogy library. Wendy, they'll talk about that too. But as I'm mentioning this, one thing that comes to me is all of these things are located at the downtown branch. And as the library is looking at building branches, it's possible to have local history collections at each branch, smaller collections. But this is sort of, it's a unique thing that the downtown branch has, and as these new branches are being planned, is to make room for that, and for the genealogy collections to see that this is used by everyone, and is, you know, is to have it in one place. And another thing that's unique to the downtown branch, besides the Californiana and local history rooms, is the things in storage, and those are upstairs. And the library collects government documents, mostly city documents and some county environmental impact reports, annual budgets, and you know, we get a lot of use for that kind of thing. And it's historical information too is useful because, say, as an example, last year with the drought, and people were looking at alternative resources for water storage in the county. And people, well, why don't we build more dams? Well, then you could go back and see. You know, people would look at these reports, and yes, we looked at dams back in 1970 or something, and this is the reasons why it didn't work, or that kind of thing. That kind of historical material is there, too. So that's pretty much what's there. And then the question comes, well, what do we do now? What do we do next? How do we keep these materials safe? And then how do we make them accessible to people? One of the ways is through digitizing as much as we can. That's one aspect of it. But it's also important to remember that digitizing something is not preserving it. It's making it available to people. But it turns out often when something's available on the internet, people want to see the original source, and especially important like maps and for local materials. And then the other part, what to do next, is just for the commission or the Jake Myers board, whoever the planning people, to look at how do you balance accessibility with security, and how do you continue to collect things? Because I'm always impressed that what we're doing now, what we're using are like visitor guides to Santa Cruz, those kinds of things. We don't see that as history, but 50 years, 75 years from now, people will want that material. And so it's good to take the long view on what we have and recognize it's important and to keep it for people. And then I'll turn it over to Anne, we'll talk about the web content and the things we have been doing to make things available digitally for people.
Yeah. So we hopefully bring this up. Yeah, sorry, I have to kind of turn around because I'm better to this.
End, if that's okay. I was going to do a wrap-up, sort of. My goal here at the end is really to have a conversation about there's a lot of policy issues around history in the library. It may not seem that way when we first start talking about it, because at first it's of course. But I think you're going to see a lot of policy issues by the time we get to the end, especially as we build our new building. And many of you have a long history with the library. I mean, one of our problems with history is that we've been funded locally, and we're told not to think necessarily regionally within our buildings. But there is economies of scale in providing history. That means that by working together, we can do it more cheaply. And so there is this issue around the downtown building doing what is a regional role for all the communities, and how that is or isn't recognized under our funding, which becomes a really fundamental question. But let's keep moving, because the other thing I like to say is that there's sort of three legs to history programming. You have to create materials that are interesting. You have to have materials that are interesting. You have to figure out how to get those materials to the public in some way. You have to provide access. And you actually have to build an audience. And so what's interesting is Deb spends a lot of her time on making sure the library has the right materials. And Anne's going to talk to you about how do we provide access. And really, the Genealogical Society does both. But in some ways, they're this grassroots organization that builds audience for this. And you need all three to be really successful at this.
And I was actually glad when you first said, you know, talk about where the library's going. So just made me think, wow, local history. What I was going to show you today is hopefully where we're going, you know, with this just site, but it's also where we've been.
Yeah.
So it's nice in that way. And I just want to say, first of all, that this working on local history is just one of my absolute most favorite projects I get to do in the library. Because to me, it feels like every day when I'm working on it, I get to go into Grandma's attic. You know that feeling when you're poking around in places and there are dark corners and there are boxes that haven't been opened and you get to peek inside them and you just know that the next one is going to have the next great Antiques Roadshow thing in it. All those dusty corners. So it's fun and it's exciting and there's something new all the time. The challenge with it is that it's like being in Grandma's attic. And Grandma's a little bit of a hoarder. And there is stuff everywhere, and it's not necessarily organized. It's of all different types and shapes. There's newspapers, there are photographs, there are postcards, there are recordings, there are anything you can think of. They're piled up in Grandma's attic. And what we're trying to do is to put some sort of order on it, you know, to the extent that people can, that it becomes more usable for people, that they can find things that they're looking for. But not to completely take away that joy of serendipity, you know, that's part of being in that attic. So hopefully this project can capture a little bit of that. So through the course of working on this local history project, I've seen this data move a long ways. So I still remember seeing the local news index written out on the little actual index cards. You remember all the friends sitting there, and actually I think they still do.
Yeah.
I'm not sure they do index cards, but they put the things on index cards, and you had stacks of index cards, and then back in the olden days, and I hate to say I was here for those, they would take those index cards, and somebody would very diligently type them up. We'd come up with nice pages of all the indexes, and then they would get bound in a book, and that book would get put behind the reference desk, so that now at least when somebody came up and asked a question, the records librarian could take the book out and, you know, go through and find what they were looking for. And then they went from there to, wow, let's put this into a gigantic Word document, because then at least whoever brings it up on the computer can do, you know, search for it. They can find Joe Schmo in this big gigantic Word document. That's a little bit better. And then the next step was, let's take that Word document, let's move all that stuff into Excel spreadsheets, because now we can sort the columns by date, and it's getting better and better. And then I came along and I'm like, oh no, we need to put these in databases, because the web was just kind of starting, and we could make things accessible to the web now. So I was all excited. No, we need to take these out of the Excel spreadsheets and we'll build databases for them. And we did that. And that was all great because you could search them through the web and it made it available to a lot of people. But the problem with that was that when I did that, I took all those different types. something that people had to know to go, if I'm looking for my Uncle Joe's something, I need to look in the photo collection. Then I need to go and I need to look in the local news index. Then I need to go look in the historic clipping props. We've got all these great resources, but they're silos, right? So the next step that we're taking right now is to try and bring everything under one roof. And that's what this new history portal is about. So what we want is to have one place where people can go, and this isn't, it's not quite up yet. But I'm hoping we're going to get it up this next week, actually. So it's still organized by, and I should also mention that we know we're not doing this in vain. We have an audience for this, because we know that just through our current web statistics. So about 30% of all of the hits on the content on our website are for local history resources. So even as things stand now, with things in these separate buckets where people don't necessarily know that they have to go to six different places to search for Uncle Joe, we're still getting about 20,000 hits a month on our local history resources. So hopefully by bringing things all together, it's going to make things more findable. People can just go to history.santacruzpl.org, type something in to find what they're looking for, and it'll be a lot easier that way. It'll make things more accessible and open. So we know there are a lot of people out there that are interested in this, and it's true that most people are local who have that interest because we're all here. But we get a lot of interesting feedback from all over the world where people find connections that maybe they didn't even know they had to Santa Cruz. A lot of them are doing genealogical research, and they come across something on our site, or, you know, they're looking for something. Another woman in New Zealand was writing a book. She wanted me to go take a picture of the house for her. So, you know, she found some reference to that somewhere on the website. I'm just going to read you really quick an email that we got from a woman that I thought was really, really nice. She says, "Dear Sir, Madam, I don't know how to actually start this message, and I have absolutely no idea if I'm writing to the right address. But I hope that you can provide me with some information, though. My name is Tari Essers, and I am from the Netherlands. I live in the vicinity of the Netherlands American Cemetery in Margrave. My family has adopted a grave of a soldier named Frederick T. Blomberg. We visit his grave a couple of times per year and put flowers in it. Ever since we adopted the grave, my family and I have been curious about who Frederick was, and we tried multiple times to get more background information about him. But until today, I never succeeded. After my visit to the cemetery today, I decided to do some extra research, and I found a link to your website. I got really excited to finally get to know something more, and this is also the reason why I decided to email you. I have read the information about Frederick T. Blomberg, but I am secretly hoping that you might know something more about him. Maybe you have some photo or even contact details of this soldier's family. Please be so kind to give me some clue about who I can ask or contact in search of more information." So it's just that these personal connections, it's just really satisfying to see that happening. I think Deborah answered her.
And then she sent us, we have some information about him on the website, and then she sent us a photo from his grave that she had taken when they go in.
Right.
So we put that now.
So here's a good example just to start with. So this is the new history portal. And I'm just going to do just a real quick tour. We could start off by typing this in. Sorry for the slowness on this. We've got this on a development site right now. So anyway, here's his record. Just typed in his last name. And it's very funny because I'd only put up this information about him. It was in this group of remembering our own about Santa Cruz veterans done by Robert Nelson about a week or 2 weeks before we got her email. It hadn't been up there at all before that. And just by chance, we throw this up just because we were working on it. We wanted to see it up and work on the pages. And then about a week later, she sent us this email, and she had found it already. So So this is his record with all this information about him. There's the picture she sent of the grave, with the flowers she's put on it. And we do have a picture of him. So she was Deborah was able to send her more information about that. So as you can see, this is still organized in a sense by collections, just because it's easier for people to get an overview of the sorts of things that we've got. And from here, you can just go into any collection. And at the top of each collection, there's a carousel. And every time you go to the collection, here's the serendipity part, it'll give you a new set of photographs in the carousel. And you can scroll through those and look at those and just kind of browse through them. There's a description of the collection, and then there are all of the different items in the collection. You can browse through those. Look at the pictures. We've got all sorts of things, all sorts of photographs going back into, I think, the 1860s. Because photographs going back into there. So currently in this database, we've got about right around 100,000 items in the database at this point that are all indexed and searchable. And there's more and more. There's lots of stuff in the attic that we just got to get out of the box and then put in there. It's also a nice way of just being able to draw connections. So I did a search the other day for, I saw this name in one of our indexes, and I thought, well, what do we have in there? So I just stuck his name in here, and it comes out, we've got something here from, it looks like the Phaelis file that Deborah was talking about before. So she had written all sorts of information about him. We also, in our photo collection, we have a picture of him. Looks like a crazy guy. And then we've got a lot of references to him in various newspaper articles that you could go through and read those articles to kind of get a picture of his life at the time. So that's just kind of a really quick overview of the site and how it works. This isn't working right now, but this is the forum Deborah mentioned, but the local researchers had asked us to host a forum on our site. And so we're hoping that this can be a place where the local researchers lurk, and that not only researchers can ask questions to each other, but that regular people can post questions and be answered as well, and start conversations going back and forth on various local history topics of interest. So, to me, the libraries. We've been talking a lot about libraries as community, libraries as a part of the community, and the role that they play in the community. And to me, there's nothing more communal than the local history collection. I mean, it's really our collective memories. It's what makes us who we are, what makes this place what it is. And I'm standing here showing you all this, but the truth is that none of this could have happened without all of the work that was done by all of the members of the community. You know, we've had people giving us photographs. We've had our snapshot stories collection there is from events that we've held around the county where we've invited members of the community to come with their old photos that they've got from home, and we'll scan them for them and put them up on the website. We've got all sorts of little nuggets from them. We've got local authors who've given us permission to put their articles and their writing and even their books online. We've had genealogical society members who have donated information to us and cooperated and helped us bring things online. The Friends of the Library have helped with indexing. And I mean, it just goes on and on. People come into the library with personal collections wanting to give them to us to do something with them. So this is one way that we can put them together. So I just feel like it's really very representative of the community working together and the place of the library in the community.
Thanks, Anne. Mm-hmm. And so next, I think we should turn to the Genealogical Society. We've got Janine, Dan, and Susan, I think, speaking tonight. Learn a little bit about
first
the work.
First, talk to you every day and give us a brief history of our society itself. So I'm Vice President.
Hi, Dan.
Good evening. Nice to see you all. I thought I'd open with just reading our mission statement, the way we think of ourselves and what we're about. The mission of the Genealogical Society of Santa Cruz County is to foster and nurture interest in genealogy by providing guidance, information, and inspiration while encouraging the broader public in the development of family histories and genealogical records using state-of-the-art resources. So our society is right now just past 45 years at work. In 1971, a little gaggle of folks began to gather. Some of them just from the general public in the various corners of the community, and some from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Folks were crossing paths. The Mormon Church, every church community within the Mormon Church has a family history center. They're generally small, but they do provide a start for local family history research and discovery. So people had crossed paths, and this was the seed for the Genealogical Society of Santa Cruz County, Genealogical Society of Santa Cruz County. Within a year or so, about 30 people were meeting regularly, and the galvanizing activity at that time was they organized classes because, you know, they recognized that they didn't know a whole lot and they saw each other as a resource. So they organized classes. I mean, these were just regular folks organizing classes to teach one another. Different folks had books. They brought books together and they shared information from the books. That was the springboard activity for the Genealogical Society of Santa Cruz County. They met at night, so it was after work. They left over any sense of tiredness from the day of work. The way that resources were built to keep these classes interesting and fresh and vibrant was rummage sales. Folks would gather, you know, odds and ends, disposables, things that they thought they could cut loose with that somebody else might like. And they held regular and sometimes irregular rummage sales to raise money to buy more books. That was how the Genealogical Society's book collection began. At first, those books were stashed into boxes. Once they became the Genealogy Society's collection, they were stashed in boxes. But before long, the boxes outstripped cupboards and, you know, little niches and for storage that that people, you know, found in their homes or you know, central places where they started to meet. Somebody approached the Grant Supporting branch of the public library. There was a spare room there, and that actually, I think 1978 was when the society started meeting there. That was the first time I'd been a member of the Genealogy Society twice. That was the first time I became a member, and I was like, I think 25 years old when I first joined the society.
That long ago?
Yeah, hey, it's amazing how it's mounted. So I remember going to those meetings in that little room at the Branch 40 Branch Library, and you know, people just gathered around. I mean, like a table, a couple of tables about this size, and and then there'd be a few extra chairs, and those were the early meetings of the society. Pretty exciting. I mean, like, as a 25-year-old with just little snippets of family history, wow, to sit down with people and hear folks talk about their family stories just, like, so fascinated me. It was way awesome. So anyway, the society stayed at the Branson 40 branch for a while. The collection grew, the membership grew, and by the early 1990s, 1991, the society had outgrown that little room in the Branson 40 Library, and the Branson 40 Library needed more space too. So graciously, the downtown branch...
I can't take any credit.
The downtown branch welcomed the society there and fit us in alongside the Californiana collection, which was an excellent fit. I mean, just Thursday, I do the Thursday morning shift, and just Thursday I was helping somebody on their family history, and we made use of the Californiana collection to learn about their family, both in Santa Cruz and elsewhere in California. So it is a really nice fit. 1991 is when we made that move. There were a couple other developments along the way. We did for a while meet at the Cessna House in Cabrillo with our monthly meetings. Right now, we meet in the conference room with our monthly meetings. We generally invite a guest speaker. And at this point, we're limited to 63 people because that's the capacity of the conference room. But the way we learned that 63 was the enforceable maximum was that we spilled over that regularly up until about 2 years ago, I think. We drew as many as 100 people in. And when safety authorities found out about that, they reminded us that 63 was the maximum. So that's what we've been at for a couple of years. And it's just to say that there's really a lot of interest that we could address and serve, in accommodating conditions. So, just in closing, our membership now is more than 200 members. Our collection now exceeds 7,500 books. Susan is the lead acquisitions resource for us. She's adding to that steadily, continually. And there are more than 50 volunteers that are working in many capacities for the society, including volunteer staffing of 60 shifts. 60. And it's actually two shifts per day in the library. Actually, I think weekends might be one shift. But so we have volunteers that are staffing close to 60 shifts in the genealogy room, doing indexing projects, scanning, like the Brayton collection is being scanned now. Correspondence, we do receive correspondence from elsewhere in the country and even occasionally elsewhere in the world. Workshops, we do workshops from time to time at different branches and different locales. And we participate from time to time in some of the history fairs or family history programs that pop up around the county. So I'd just like to close with sort of a big picture appreciation for the role that genealogy and family history play in people's lives. It's usually a secondary sort of interest on the part of most of us. You know, the frontline items are housing and food and work and children and so on and so forth. But what's fascinating is how even though family history and genealogy kind of occupy a you know, what people usually think of as a hobby or a secondary kind of interest. It's a pressing kind of secondary interest. It's one that keeps bubbling up and coming forward. And then people make extra effort to get to and not to forget. And when we do forget, we tend to feel pangs about it. We tend to feel pining is a 19th century word that sometimes, you know, touched on the longing that people feel for being connected with each other across geographies and across time spans. A former president of the California Genealogical Society described genealogy as the democratization of history. And what she was referring to when she called genealogy and family history as the democratization of history in general was that every one of us has a story that's interesting and valuable that we can draw wisdom from, that we can be entertained by. Every farm worker, every timber worker, every tannery worker, every store clerk, every public official, every business executive or small business owner, every person, every clergyman, every person has a story, and there are fascinating elements to it. And that's the endeavor that in the society I keep trying to serve and make available the resources so that people can find and share their stories. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
So
if it's okay, I'd like to say a few words. I want you to keep in mind those three things of we need to have materials, we need to have access to those materials, because there's a lot of history museums in this country that are open 2 hours a week and you can only look at somebody's files. And we need to build audience to make the expense of preserving those things worthwhile to the taxpayers, okay? So I keep going back to those three because I think the outcome is a balance between those three sort of activities. The other thing I want to say is this concept of archive. I have to say that public libraries across the country try their damnedest not to be an archive. We aren't funded for it. We're structurally not set up for it. The one place libraries tend to make the exception is around local history. It's the one place where, and especially if we're in an environment where there isn't an alternative. I come from an urban area. Each county had a county historical society that had libraries and did a lot of this work and had sort of those archive spaces. But I find in more the regional economic centers, the public library does play this role. And I think that really is why Santa Cruz is playing this role. The other thing I want to say about history in the library is history's the best friend of a library in some ways. There is no better project for a student than a local history homework assignment for teaching them how to use a library and how to use alternative resources than Google. And I have to say, I wish in Minnesota it was a requirement in 6th and 8th grade that every student do a local history project. My dream someday is to do that here because it forced all public public education students into the library to do those projects. And it was this amazing opportunity for librarians to get their hands on kids and have the opportunity to talk to them about research. But we also find there's this huge audience with adults, you know, on their own. What we're trying to do in public libraries is to teach people the joy of lifelong learning. And I think, Anne, you described this experience of, you know, uncovering a mystery. I think if an adult has an experience like that, it often turns them on to lifelong learning in a way that almost nothing else can. And especially with our older adults, this is a topic of immense interest And I completely agree. If we had the spaces for it, we could get really significantly sized audiences for a lot of our programming. We're just not really set up very well for it. So what are some of my concerns? We need to coordinate better between the Genealogical Society, the library, USC, the MA, so that we're not duplicating each other's efforts, okay? I think we're well down this road, but I think more can be done. You know, MA is sort of the stated history museum in the community, but I think that MA is de facto defining what their piece is, so we need to define what our piece is. And I have the feeling it's going to balance out to objects. A museum is a collector of objects, and a library is more of the collector of information. But we'll see how that all works out. But I think this coordination really needs to happen. Part of this is, if you want to do an archive, and if you want to do an archive well, it has immense implications for facilities and staffing, and it can be wildly expensive. So it's really important that we don't duplicate archival functions, that we say, you're going to do these bits and we're going to do these bits, because this community can't afford multiple archives. And to be honest, the library isn't funded for an archive, so it's an interesting conversation. You know, with some of the materials we have, we've pulled them out and put them in a back room, but they really should be in climate-controlled spaces. They should be handled with gloves. I have run into two rings of thieves, professionals who go and steal. These are collections that thieves know about, and the smaller the venue, the more vulnerable you are because you have less security. You know, you can get robbed blind on items like this. So you just have to be, we have to articulate what we keep, what we don't keep, and why. But in this, within the library, we also have to articulate what we centralize and what we decentralize. There are economies of scale by holding it all downtown in one space. A researcher can get all of their job done. When we went out and talked to the communities last year, they said, we want to have local history sections in all of the libraries. We don't always want to have to go downtown. So I want to honor that, but we need to really understand what that means. We have a floating collection, so theoretically everything floats around. Our history collection does not float. Maybe we create history collections in each of the branches that don't float as well. Maybe unique copies are downtown, but we get duplicates of local so that we have them in the local branches. But those are important discussions to have with our communities because we clearly heard that they want some of that held locally. The great news is the digitization piece makes it all the time everywhere. So again, that's definitely a long-term solution. The thing I like about digitization is it increases the possibility of use. Right now, so much of our collection is beholden to the hours in which we're open, which can be limited. I'm so grateful that the Genealogical Society is very generous with their room, and they don't. I have seen so many groups say you can only use it when someone's there with the help of someone. And it really does reduce access and reduce use. But what we need to do is digitize more. Digitizing is expensive. I could literally have Deb spend the rest of her career digitizing. I could. But again, I have also seen digital databases that go unused because we haven't figured out how to make them accessible. And one of the things that's frustrating to me is the primary way in which people use the library digitally is through the catalog. And so what we need to do is build this access between our digitized information and the catalog so that when they search in the catalog, that they can go straight to the digital resource. If you have 12, and this is where consolidating all of these collections together and being able to search them as a whole is a huge step forward for us, because before you had to know about all 10 collections. Do you see what I'm saying? And so what we have to keep doing, though, is creating tools like what Anne's doing that makes it more and more and more accessible. We've got to provide access. Okay, I think we've got a built-in audience, but the truth of the matter is to have a group of volunteers. I love that your mission statement says nurture interest. Because the way I justify this to the JPA, the expenditures on these activities, is use. And so we need people in the community. This can be the most hyper-local activity, I think was something Deb had said. But we need to keep generating interest in this, making people aware of the power of what's in these collections, and then justifying our investment by demonstrating the use. And I love that we have a local grassroots group of people that care passionately about this. We need to maintain this through the next generation. So the Genealogical Society needs more 25-year-olds. But they had some in the past. So we've got to figure out how to make that. We also have to do more programming in the library proper. We also need to support more programming. All of this is going to come to a major policy question with the downtown library. So each jurisdiction's paying for their own buildings, right? The JPA likes to think that each library building is independent unto itself. This is one of those areas where it is not. And it's economies of scale that allows us to digitize and put into a database centrally that we can all work from. But we still need a place for the print. And we need a place for the activity. It doesn't mean we can't do genealogical programs at all 10 libraries when we get appropriate spaces. But there still needs to be the center of activity. And it is not just a downtown benefit. And so that is where I'm really struggling. I also have to say that every square foot downtown is going to cost us at least $750. So as we build this, there's going to be a perpetual arm wrestle about, is this activity worthy? Okay. And I just want to talk about a problem that came in that Deb's been helping with. The Sentinel is moving from Scotts Valley to Santa Cruz. They have all the print copies of the Sentinel going back in time. They want to give them up.
Who's that?
The Sentinel.
Did you mean that the Sentinel is moving from Santa Cruz to Scotts Valley?
From Scotts Valley to Santa Cruz.
Oh, it's coming back.
And I think they're going down to 20% of their physical space. So they want to give up the physical copies of the Sentinel. This is an immense and important information resource for our community. Deb's been doing a ton of research about what is digitized, what isn't digitized, how do we do this, what would it take to hold them, how much physical space are they in. At $750 a square foot, I don't think we can build the space. But I think we absolutely have to ensure that every single page of the Sentinel is digitized before someone says, that's it. So we're in these conversations now of trying to figure out what has been digitized and what hasn't been digitized. And I think the proposal we're putting together is we need to take pieces, though, and we need to ensure that they get digitized. But you can see that this is fraught with policy implications, but I guarantee the extent to which all of the Sentinel is digitized, it will be a resource our community uses into perpetuity. But do we build 1,000 square feet for old sentinels? If we don't, do we throw them away? Sorry, this is making us all gasp a little bit. But I think it's the perfect example. And especially as the baby boomers retire, I don't know, I just had my father pass. And I would guess he left 20,000 photographs. And as a child, what do you do with that? We're going to get so much of this in the next 20 years, and these resources are going to be amazing. And this community does not have a full-time historical society. We have huge questions in front of us of how are we going to handle and manage this. And so I wanted to show you possibilities. I wanted to show you exciting grassroots things that are happening. In some ways, history's all good at the library. We're moving ahead. But in some ways, I'm really daunted by the scope of the challenges and the fiscal realities. And I'm sorry, Nancy, you had a question.
I think it's a question about how much do you work with the local history museums?
Like the genealogical society?
No, actually the archives.
Okay, what I really want to do is finish our presentation.
Oh.
We have not talked about our collection yet or our contributions. So if you don't mind, Susan, I'd like to finish our presentation.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize it.
Oh, no, that was...
one person. We have
Susan L. would like to talk about our collection,
okay.
And then I would like to tell you about what we've accomplished this last year.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I had no idea. I did.
Okay. So Susan is our panel member.
Yes, I'm on the board of directors of the Genealogy Society, and I'm also the reference book cataloger. And I'll tell you a little bit about that in just a minute. So our library holdings began at the beginning of the society in 1972 when people were had been ordering materials, books on their own, and so they donated them. As Dan said, they were kind of hauled around in books from here to there. And now we have more than 7,500 volumes in our collection, and it's housed in the Californiana room in the downtown library. As Dan mentioned, this room also houses the public library's collection of books pertaining to California history. So the proximity of these two collections is really convenient for patrons who might want a bit of historical background on a California ancestor that they're doing research on. Our society acquires books in one of two ways, either by purchase or by donation. The GSSCC budgets $1,500 each year toward the purchase of new books for our library. We have an acquisitions committee that meets twice a year for the purpose of ordering new books. Each committee member spends volunteer time searching for titles that we don't already have, and believe it or not, it's kind of hard to find titles we already have already, because we do have such a really extensive collection. So then we meet as a group to decide on which books to order. In addition, any member of our society can request that the acquisitions committee purchase a particular book. We regularly receive donations, either one or two at a time, or an entire collection. Last year, we received 6 crates of books from the Sarah Bunnett family. Sarah was a librarian and one of the GSSCC founders. So other volunteers helped me when we have such a large collection that arrives. First, we have to determine whether a book contains genealogy or is it really just history. If it contains genealogy, then we need to look it up on the SCPL system and see whether we have that book already. And if it is strictly history, we donate it to the Friends of the Library. Our library collection is not on the Dewey Decimal System. When it first started, it was determined that since our subject range is limited to genealogy, an acquisition number system would be preferred. Every title that we bring into our collection gets an acquisition number and then a call number. As the reference cataloger, I'm the person who gives our books their call number. Then I send the books to Library Tech Services, where the library staff enters the book into the public library system and gives it a barcode label.
All of our books are in the public library system and are easily accessible online. However, our books are for reference only and may not be checked out. I have frequent interactions with the library staff who are always very helpful to me. For example, Shelley Bottomer referred me to a website where I could order archival boxes that we needed for very fragile books published in the late 1800s. Those books are on the shelf now in archival boxes. And if I have questions about a call number, Freelance of Tangos is always accessible and helpful. Our library contains several special collections. First, the Tina Brayton collection contains information on families in primarily the upper southeastern states, Tennessee, Kentucky, in that area, and is currently housed in 560 binders on shelves on a wall of our library. We have volunteers who are currently working on scanning and digitizing this collection so that we will be able to put it on our website and eliminate the binders. It's a very slow process. Next, we have the Thales collection. I was kind of surprised to hear that there's duplication here, so I'm not going to repeat anything, but we need to talk.
Yeah,
we
do.
Actually, I was working with, it's not duplicated. It's, we're using those things that were in your...
Oh, I should go ahead and say what I was going to say. Okay, now let's go. Okay. She was a GSSC member and resident of the San Lorenzo Valley area who kept records on people and businesses in the area. This collection, mainly between 1870 and 1920, is on 4x6 cards, as we saw on the screen, but is also indexed on a CD. It was originally funded by a grant from the San Jose State University History Department. Last, we have the folks file. I don't know if Anne knows about the folks file. You did, okay. So it looks like what you had was the folks file.
The folks file is, I didn't have a link to it up there, but it's up on our website. There will be a link to it from our...
To the folks?
Wonderful.
Well, the folks file is getting up there.
Wonderful.
It's in transit right now.
Wow.
So, but the name index, you've got your people index?
Go ahead and say about that. The folks file is an indexed database of Santa Cruz County people and events. So when you search by a person's name, you will find a wide variety of articles related to that person, such as places they lived and their occupation. The obituary article lists the names of family members of the deceased. So there's a lot more information that one would find on, say, Ancestry.com. The Californiana Room also houses a large collection of newspaper microfilm. Local newspapers dating from the 1850s to the 1950s have been indexed through the efforts of Friends of the Library and the Genealogical Society. Our GSSCC volunteers, who staff our library collection in two shifts daily, are trained in how to operate the microfilm and microfiche readers, as well as the copy machine in order to assist patrons. Our volunteers are also trained in how to use Ancestry.com Library Edition and the other genealogy search engines available at the library. We have blank pedigree charts so that our volunteers can participate in those who want to get started on their ancestry research. Within the broad umbrella term of genealogy, our collection covers a wide range of topics. Historical periods include, for example, colonial, New England, U.S. Revolution, the Civil War. We have genealogical books on every state. Our largest collection is state collections, California, of course, and within that we have six or more shelves devoted just to Santa Cruz. We have a foreign genealogy section with books related to Canada, England, Germany, Ireland, and more. There's a family section where a whole book is devoted to the ancestry and descendants of a particular surname. We also have a large collection of how-to books, such as How to Find Your German Ancestors, How Old Photographs, Clothing, and Hat Styles Can Help You Find Your Ancestors, Guide to DNA Testing and Genetic Genealogy, and many more. Our society used to keep printed census records, both federal and state. Since that information is now available online, we eliminated those items from our collection to make room for new acquisitions. The GSSCC belongs to several genealogy societies, such as the New England Historical and Genealogy Society in Boston. Our membership includes their scholarly journal, the Register, which contains thoroughly researched and footnoted genealogical articles. So we have like a whole wall in our library is journals that we have collected over the years. We have a collection of similar journals from other societies, some of which may not yet be accessible online. All of the work in our library is done by society member volunteers. Our office manager collects our mail from the post office and distributes it, as well as maintains our supply of paper and office materials. Our website is maintained by a computer tech-savvy member. Each library staff volunteer has a section of the library to monitor for misplaced or missing books and to dust the books and the shelves in their area. Our library functions very well and provides a variety of services to patrons because of all of our very dedicated volunteers.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm sorry I cut you off early. Janine.
Well, we're not done yet. Janine has a turn.
Hi, I'm Janine Charles, and I'm the president of the Genealogical Society. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and our fiscal year runs July 1st through June 30th, so we are now just ending our fiscal year. We have a membership of 220 people. We meet once a month in the upstairs meeting room of the downtown branch. Our presentations are free and open to the public. And here are some accomplishments for the past year. Our organization consists of 50 volunteers. No one gets paid to the Genealogical Society at all. It's all volunteer. And we staff the genealogy desk at the downtown branch every day of the year. We average between 500 and 600 volunteer library hours per month. We submit our voluntary hours monthly to volunteer coordinator Denise Fish. She has all the volunteer hours that we put together. Throughout the year, we hold various workshops at library branches throughout the county. The purpose of the workshops is to teach library patrons how to use Ancestry.com Library Edition. And they have been very well attended and very well receptive, and we've been doing them at several of the branches. In February, the workshop is here at the Aptos branch, followed by another one in France of 40 in April. And we're working closely with librarian Sandy Imperio to coordinate more workshops. And currently, we're looking at the next workshop being at Scotts Valley Branch. In March and every spring, we hold a beginner's genealogy workshop for people who have an interest in learning how to do genealogy. And we have that at the downtown location, and that's always well attended. We have been very actively promoting the newspapers.com subscription that is available at all library branches. We assisted virtual services librarian Diane Cowan in evaluating this product before purchase. When she was evaluating, we gave her quite a bit of feedback and encouraged her very much to purchase newspapers.com. And I just want all of you to know that you can get newspapers.com from your home computer at home with using your library card. And one fun thing to do is to look up the children's birth announcements in the Sentinel if they were born in the county. I did that for my kids, and they had a ball reading it. You know, well, I know we all could have had it somewhere, but it's fun to be able to retrieve it. So we held a tour presentation at the October general meeting where we demonstrated using Ancestry.com and also newspapers.com. We also demonstrated it at the Santa Cruz History Fair. In March, we had a table and demonstrated it at the Discovery Fair at the Family History Center here in Santa Cruz. So we do promote newspapers.com quite a bit. And I know that the library has been happy with the level of hits you're getting from newspapers.com. We produce a newsletter bi-monthly to all members of our society that basically just tells you, I have a president's message up front and the events that are happening at the libraries that pertain to genealogy, and then some of our members will donate articles on their genealogical research. And in our next edition, which is coming out the end of this month, John Laird's going to be submitting a fantastic article on how he found all this information, or all these photographs on eBay for his family. Yeah. He had to pay for it. He wasn't given them.
Interesting.
Okay, recently, we sent a check in the amount of $935 for our portion of the library subscription to Heritage Quest for the period of July 1st, 2017 to June 30th, 2018. And Heritage Quest is another genealogical database that you can access from your home to the Royal Library using the library card. We also paid, the Genealogical Society also paid $200 towards the subscription of AmericanAncestors.org. And we worked with librarian Sarah Harbison on both of these transactions. We have DNA workshops every quarter before our general meetings. And we were holding them more often, but the JPA could not guarantee that the space we reserved would be available. So we try to schedule our workshops on a night that the JPA works, on the evenings that they meet together, so there's no conflict during the day. We maintain the display case in the Californiana room. We have a query service for in and out of state patrons. We provide interlibrary loan services for films and fish. We have an indexing group that has been indexing old versions of the Santa Cruz newspapers for several years now. They have been working closely with history librarian Deborah Lahoma and programmer analyst Andrew Phipps so that a keyword search are now available on the Santa Cruz Public Library website. We provide 9 professional speaker presentations at our general meetings with no charge. We pay for insurance coverage of our entire collection. And I want to take this opportunity to thank Deborah Lapoma for all her assistance in answering all my questions in a very timely manner. Gabe Rays has been exceedingly helpful with getting us the meeting room arrangements. James Lee is very helpful as well. And Susan Nimitz has been very approachable, and we very much appreciate your participation with us. Our next goal is to promote the AmericanAncestors.org that the library just recently purchased as a subscription to let people know that it is available at the library. But unlike the other subscriptions, you do need to go to the library to actually access those databases. And I'm going to leave you all with a little pamphlet that tells about our society. There's also a application inside for you to enjoy. That's $25 a year. And we have a wonderful, wonderful membership that's well attended. And we have a very good relationship with the library. And for that, we're very grateful. Thank you. Yes.
I just want to say that's darn impressive, your organization. I mean, I had no idea of all the details. I really didn't. And,
that's why we really welcome the opportunity to tell you.
You guys are awesome. Just that you've held together for so many years and developed your organization. It's just, wow.
It's really
impressive. And I'd love to see the newsletter. Are those available?
Yes, at the library has this one, and we have one coming out soon.
Oh, okay.
And if you're, I believe all of your emails are on the website. And if they are, I can send you the electronic version of our next one, which is coming out for John Laird.
Yeah, I'd love to read that.
Okay.
I would also encourage you to join in to encourage others to join. I find the newsletter very interesting, and the annual meeting was a great deal of fun, and it's just a really interesting group of people, and really across the entire area.
Are these available at all the branches?
Yes, they are.
Okay. I haven't seen it before, so cool.
Well, I assume they are, so thank you for asking that good question. I will find out and make sure that they are. Thank you.
That's a lot of information.
So I did have a question then that I started to ask before, which was, I was trying to figure out, because I know that there's some pretty dynamic history museums in the county. Like, I know Capitola has one, Boulder Creek has one, Felton's going to have a new one, it's going to partner with Boulder Creek. And I've seen Boulder Creek's archival collection. It's really impressive. So I'm just wondering, how much do you coordinate with the local, you know, chapters of the historical society?
We have several members of our society are also members of those societies.
Yeah.
And even on the board, I don't know if you know Lisa Robbins.
Yeah, I do.
She's on our board of directors as well.
Okay.
So we'll get donations of maps, and Lisa will look at it because she's got connections beyond the library.
She does.
And we pass them on to her to find the right spots for them.
So then does the library then connect with you guys?
All right. So, yeah, I can address.
Okay.
Yeah. First of all, to me, I'm struck with how many little museums there are in this county.
Yeah,
the smallest county in area in the state of San Francisco. Okay, like we've got so many school districts. We have like county museums. Each community has their own museum.
Oh, yeah.
So I see our role as being like a centralized source that I've like outreach to the museum saying these are the resources we have, and we also then like keep our ear to the ground of what things they're doing and making sure that we have their books that are added to the collection. I kind of keep a communication going between the different museums. But also, I wanted to say, I know an example of things that we do as a library that they don't do or can't do is, for example, the Athos History Museum has an article by Kevin Weehouse that comes out a lot in the Athos Times, like, you know, history. And so what we do is we read those, each of these, like, Capitola ones or Scott's Valley newsletters, and we clip those and keep those and index them. And then eventually, like, you can. The goal is to scan them and have them available on the library's website. So that's kind of like we are sort of a central clearinghouse, and then making sure that we have both books and other publications. But again, we're a library collecting books, we're not an archive. And when I think of an archive, I think of it as collecting personal papers or memoirs, that kind, you know, those kinds of things, which the library can't do. So we can work together and try to inform them about what the library has, and then we keep, you know, familiar with what they have. And hopefully with this new history forum, if we get that up, that'll be even a greater resource that we can share more information together.
Okay. Dan?
Is it okay to ask a question?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious about the policy dilemma that you framed, Susan. And how archiving, because I heard you say that a library's mission is a community information resource. Is that accurate?
And it would specify a public library.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so my curiosity is how and Deborah or any of you are welcome to, you know, parts of the question. How do you distinguish archival? How do you characterize what is archival and what is community information? Because archival is the definition of archival. You know, the original source and it's stored versus something that's multi-copied and in circulation. How do you?
I don't think this has been defined, and I would say it's one of my policy questions for us as a library system. So the question of the original source and whether we keep it is a really fundamental question to that. So as we digitize stuff, does that mean we can throw away the original? I don't know. And so these, and I think Deb very much gave what we're trying to do, like what is the extent of our archive. But I don't think we have anything written. I think we've been, we have too few staff, spread too thin, trying to do the best we can. But I have the feeling that the building is going to prompt some really hard questions, including how far are you going to go on an archive? What are your limits? And I don't know the answer yet. And I think digitization is part of the solution, but I don't think it's the only solution. There's going to be a place for some print. What print? And so as the board that will help make these operational choices, again, great things going on, some really kind of tough policy questions coming up.
A little specific question. You mentioned that, that the library has government docs, like, so we have EIRs and different. Is that consistent? Is that something that the county or the city is consistently, every time there's an environmental report, that they're giving a copy to the library, or it's just kind of hodgepodge?
It's pretty hodgepodge. It's not like we're not like a depository where they're required to have, but I believe the city has been really good about making sure that the library, they give copies.
So there's an official designation, which we do not have, and I would not want.
Yeah.
They take tens of thousands of square feet at a minimum. The general printing office, the federal government is, I think, remarkably behind in terms of its own digitization process. So in order to maintain that designation, it's problematic. You have to keep a lot of print that gets really old. I think what we're trying to keep, though, are things that are really relevant to this community rather than a broad array of government docs.
Why do you say the city? Yeah, the city specific, city of Santa Cruz, I think, is really good about making sure. And in fact, a lot of these kind of EIRs, it's a requirement that they have these things publicly available.
Uh-huh.
And so those are also the ones that we would get from the county. Probably the ones that are required for public dissemination. But we don't collect, a lot of county stuff. It's mostly city of Santa Cruz.
And so they have a requirement to make transparency and available information, but is there any kind of support in terms of...
Financial, no.
Yeah.
No.
And I think this is something we're also going to see that I'm hearing rumors about is... More, there's the 7 years that you have to hold documents, but I think governments around the country are looking at what is the historical record we need to maintain, and can we pass it off to someone else? And again, I would rather have it than lose it. But if, for example, I would guess we have 100 years of library board meeting minutes in print that ought to be digitized and made available. For every unit of government, there is something like that out there. So this is where I say we've only begun to scratch the surface on what could be a really huge issue for our community. I just want to thank everyone for coming out tonight. I think... This is such an interesting thing, and I think the library is doing such interesting work. I'm really proud of it's been going on for a long time. And I think we will continue to do so, but I think we'll be challenged.
Yeah.
Well. And think about the cool spaces we could do in the new building downtown, though, in terms of study and research. To make a compelling space.
I have a question. Do we know whether it's going to be a new building or is it going to be... We don't know yet.
I'm going to ask you guys to come to the Downtown Library Advisory Committee and to talk to this group of architects as well, probably in the next 2 months. We're just getting this arranged now. So you'll get more information. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would say if you have a requirement, we could vote on this, except I have to abstain because I was an epilepsy, so we still don't have enough.
You do not have to abstain.
Oh, from boarding from Mitchell for this. Yeah, we did this last time, actually. You reminded me. So we could go ahead and...
Do you mind?
Yeah, go for it.
Just a reminder, we've canceled the July meeting and we'll meet again in August.
Do we need to do anything for the adoption of the agenda?
I think it's okay.
Okay. So, adjournment?
Adjournment. Thank you so much.